Northanger Abbey. Chapter 1. No one who had ever seen Catherine Morland in her infancy would have supposed her born to be an heroine. Her situation in life, the character of her father and mother, her own person and disposition, were all equally against her. Her father was a clergyman, without being neglected or poor, and a very respectable man, though his name was Richard and he had never been handsome. He had a considerable independence besides two good livings, and he was not in the least addicted to locking up his daughters. Her mother was a woman of useful plain sense, with a good temper, and, what is more remarkable, with a good constitution. She had three sons before Catherine was born, and instead of dying and bringing the latter into the world, as anybody might expect, she still lived on to have six children, Moretto see them growing up around her, and to enjoy excellent health herself. A family of 10 children will be always called a fine family, where there are heads and arms and legs enough for the number, but the Morlands had little other right to the word, for they were in general very plain, and Catherine, for many years of her life, as plain as any. She had a thin awkward figure, a sallow skin without color, dark lank hair, and strong features so much for her person, and not less unpropitious for heroism seemed her mind. She was fond of all boys' plays, and greatly preferred cricket not merely to dolls, but to the more heroic enjoyments of infancy, nursing a dormouse, feeding a canary bird, or watering a rose bush. Indeed, she had no taste for a garden, and if she gathered flowers at all, it was chiefly for the pleasure of mischief, at least so it was conjectured from her always preferring those which she was forbidden to take. Such were her propensities, her abilities were quite as extraordinary. She never could learn or understand anything before she was taught, and sometimes not even then, for she was often inattentive, and occasionally stupid. Her mother was 3 months in teaching her only to repeat the beggar's petition, and after all, her next sister, Sally, could say it better than she did. Not that Catherine was always stupid, by no means, she learnt the fable of the hare and many friends as quickly as any girl in England. Her mother wished her to learn music, and Catherine was sure she should like it, for she was very fond of tinkling the keys of the old forlorn spinet, so, at 8 years old she began. She learned a year, and could not bear it, and Mrs. Morland, who did not insist on her daughter's being accomplished in spite of incapacity or distaste, allowed her to leave off. The day which dismissed the music master was one of the happiest of Catherine's life. Her taste for drawing was not superior, though whenever she could obtain the outside of a letter from her mother or seize upon any other odd piece of paper, she did what she could in that way, by drawing houses and trees, hens and chickens, all very much like one another. Writing and accounts she was taught by her father, French by her mother, her proficiency in either was not remarkable, and she shirked her lessons in both whenever she could. What a strange, unaccountable character! For with all these symptoms of profligacy at 10 years old, she had neither a bad heart nor a bad temper, was seldom stubborn, scarcely ever quarrelsome, and very kind to the little ones, with few interruptions of tyranny. She was moreover noisy and wild, hated confinement and cleanliness, and loved nothing so well in the world as rolling down the green slope at the back of the house. Such was Catherine Morland at 10. At 15, appearances were mending, she began to curl her hair and long for balls, her complexion improved, her features were softened by plumpness and color, her eyes gained more animation, and her figure more consequence. Her love of dirt gave way to an inclination for finery, and she grew clean as she grew smart. She had now the pleasure of sometimes hearing her father and mother remark on her personal improvement. "Catherine grows quite a good-looking girl, she is almost pretty today," were words which caught her ears now and then, and how welcome were the sounds. To look almost pretty is an acquisition of higher delight to a girl who has been looking plain the first 15 years of her life than a beauty from her cradle can ever receive. Mrs. Morland was a very good woman, and wished to see her children everything they ought to be, but her time was so much occupied in lying in and teaching the little ones, that her elder daughters were inevitably left to shift for themselves, and it was not very wonderful that Catherine, who had by nature nothing heroic about her, should prefer cricket, baseball, riding on horseback, and running about the country at the age of 14, to books, or at least books of information, for, provided that nothing like useful knowledge could be gained from them, provided they were all story and no reflection, she had never any objection to books at all. But from 15 to 17 she was in training for a heroine, she read all such works as heroines must read to supply their memories with those quotations which are so serviceable and so soothing in the vicissitudes of their eventful lives. From Pope, she learnt to censure those who bear about the mockery of woe. From Gray, that many a flower is born to blush unseen, and waste its fragrance on the desert air. From Thomson, that It is a delightful task to teach the young idea how to shoot. And from Shakespeare she gained a great store of information amongst the rest, that trifles light as air are, to the jealous, confirmation strong, as proofs of holy writ. That the poor beetle, which we tread upon, in corporal sufferance feels a pang as great as when a giant dies. And that a young woman in love always looks like patience on a monument smiling at grief. So far her improvement was sufficient, and in many other points she came on exceedingly well, for though she could not write sonnets, she brought herself to read them, and though there seemed no chance of her throwing a whole party into raptures by a prelude on the pianoforte of her own composition, she could listen to other people's performance with very little fatigue. Her greatest deficiency was in the pencil. She had no notion of drawing, not enough even to attempt a sketch of her lover's profile, that she might be detected in the design. There she fell miserably short of the true heroic height. At present she did not know her own poverty, for she had no lover to portray. She had reached the age of 17, without having seen one amiable youth who could call forth her sensibility, without having inspired one real passion, and without having excited even any admiration but what was very moderate and very transient. This was strange indeed. But strange things may be generally accounted for if their cause be fairly searched out. There was not one lord in the neighborhood, no, not even a baronet. There was not one family among their acquaintance who had reared and supported a boy accidentally found at their door, not one young man whose origin was unknown. Her father had no ward, and the squire of the parish no children. But when a young lady is to be a heroine, the perverseness of 40 surrounding families cannot prevent her. Something must and will happen to throw a hero in her way. Mr. Allen, who owned the chief of the property about Fullerton, the village in Wiltshire where the Morelands lived, was ordered to Bath for the benefit of a gouty constitution, and his lady, a good-humoured woman, fond of Miss Morland, and probably aware that if adventures will not befall a young lady in her own village, she must seek them abroad, invited her to go with them. Mr. and Mrs. Morland were all compliance, and Catherine all happiness. Chapter 2. In addition to what has been already said of Catherine Morland's personal and mental endowments, when about to be launched into all the difficulties and dangers of a 6 weeks' residence in Bath, it may be stated, for the reader's more certain information, lest the following pages should otherwise fail of giving any idea of what her character is meant to be, that her heart was affectionate, her disposition cheerful and open, without conceit or affectation of any kind, her manners just removed from the awkwardness and shyness of a girl, her person pleasing, and, when in good looks, pretty, and her mind about as ignorant and uninformed as the female mind at 17 usually is. When the hour of departure drew near, the maternal anxiety of Mrs. Morland will be naturally supposed to be most severe. A thousand alarming presentiments of evil to her beloved Catherine from this terrific separation must depress her heart with sadness, and drown her in tears for the last day or two of their being together, and advice of the most important and applicable nature must of course flow from her wise lips in their parting conference in her closet. Cautions against the violence of such noblemen and baronets as delight in forcing young ladies away to some remote farmhouse, must, at such a moment, relieve the fullness of her heart. Who would not think so? But Mrs. Morland knew so little of lords and baronets, that she entertained no notion of their general mischievousness, and was wholly unsuspicious of danger to her daughter from their machinations. Her cautions were confined to the following points. I beg, Catherine, you will always wrap yourself up very warm about the throat, when you come from the rooms at night, and I wish you would try to keep some account of the money you spend. I will give you this little book on purpose. Sally, or rather Sarah, for what young lady of common gentility will reach the age of 16 without altering her name as far as she can? Must from situation be at this time the intimate friend and confidant of her sister. It is remarkable, however, that she neither insisted on Catherine's writing by every post, nor exacted her promise of transmitting the character of every new acquaintance, nor a detail of every interesting conversation that Bath might produce. Everything indeed relative to this important journey was done, on the part of the Morelands, with a degree of moderation and composure, which seemed rather consistent with the common feelings of common life, than with the refined susceptibilities, the tender emotions which the first separation of a heroine from her family ought always to excite. Her father, instead of giving her an unlimited order on his banker, or even putting £100 bank bill into her hands, gave her only 10 guineas, and promised her more when she wanted it. Under these unpromising auspices, the parting took place, and the journey began. It was performed with suitable quietness and uneventful safety. Neither robbers nor tempests befriended them, nor one lucky overturn to introduce them to the hero. Nothing more alarming occurred than a fear, on Mrs. Allen's side, of having once left her clogs behind her at an inn, and that fortunately proved to be groundless. They arrived at Bath. Catherine was all eager delight. Her eyes were here, there, everywhere, as they approached its fine and striking environs, and afterwards drove through those streets which conducted them to the hotel. She was come to be happy, and she felt happy already. They were soon settled in comfortable lodgings in Pulteney Street. It is now expedient to give some description of Mrs. Allen, that the reader may be able to judge in what manner her actions will hereafter tend to promote the general distress of the work, and how she will, probably, contribute to reduce poor Catherine to all the desperate wretchedness of which a last volume is capable, whether by her imprudence, vulgarity, or jealousy, whether by intercepting her letters, ruining her character, or turning her out of doors. Mrs. Allen was one of that numerous class of females, whose society can raise no other emotion than surprise at there being any men in the world who could like them well enough to marry them. She had neither beauty, genius, accomplishment, nor manner. The air of a gentlewoman, a great deal of quiet, inactive good temper, and a trifling turn of mind were all that could account for her being the choice of a sensible, intelligent man like Mr. Allen. In one respect she was admirably fitted to introduce a young lady into public, being as fond of going everywhere and seeing everything herself as any young lady could be. Dress was her passion. She had a most harmless delight in being fine, and our heroine's entree into life could not take place till after 3 or 4 days had been spent in learning what was mostly worn, and her chaperone was provided with a dress of the newest fashion. Catherine too made some purchases herself, and when all these matters were arranged, the important evening came which was to usher her into the upper rooms. Her hair was cut and dressed by the best hand, her clothes put on with care, and both Mrs. Allen and her maid declared she looked quite as she should do. With such encouragement, Catherine hoped at least to pass uncensured through the crowd. As for admiration, it was always very welcome when it came, but she did not depend on it. Mrs. Allen was so long in dressing that they did not enter the ballroom till late. The season was full, the room crowded, and the two ladies squeezed in as well as they could. As for Mr. Allen, he repaired directly to the card room, and left them to enjoy a mob by themselves. With more care for the safety of her new gown than for the comfort of her protégé, Mrs. Allen made her way through the throng of men by the door, as swiftly as the necessary caution would allow. Catherine, however, kept close at her side, and linked her arm too firmly within her friend's to be torn asunder by any common effort of a struggling assembly. But to her utter amazement she found that to proceed along the room was by no means the way to disengage themselves from the crowd. It seemed rather to increase as they went on, whereas she had imagined that when once fairly within the door, they should easily find seats and be able to watch the dances with perfect convenience. But this was far from being the case, and though by unwearied diligence they gained even the top of the room, their situation was just the same. They saw nothing of the dancers but the high feathers of some of the ladies. Still they moved on, something better was yet in view, and by a continued exertion of strength and ingenuity they found themselves at last in the passage behind the highest bench. Here there was something less of crowd than below, and hence Miss Morland had a comprehensive view of all the company beneath her, and of all the dangers of her late passage through them. It was a splendid sight, and she began, for the first time that evening, to feel herself at a ball. She longed to dance, but she had not an acquaintance in the room. Mrs. Allen did all that she could do in such a case by saying very placidly, "Every now and then, I wish you could dance, my dear, I wish you could get a partner." For some time her young friend felt obliged to her for these wishes, but they were repeated so often, and proved so totally ineffectual, that Catherine grew tired at last, and would thank her no more. They were not long able, however, to enjoy the repose of the eminence they had so laboriously gained. Everybody was shortly in motion for tea, and they must squeeze out like the rest. Catherine began to feel something of disappointment. She was tired of being continually pressed against by people, the generality of whose faces possessed nothing to interest, and with all of whom she was so wholly unacquainted that she could not relieve the irksomeness of imprisonment by the exchange of a syllable with any of her fellow captives, and when at last arrived in the tea-room, she felt yet more the awkwardness of having no party to join, no acquaintance to claim, no gentleman to assist them. They saw nothing of Mr. Allen, and after looking about them in vain for a more eligible situation, were obliged to sit down at the end of a table, at which a large party were already placed, without having anything to do there, or anybody to speak to, except each other. Mrs. Allen congratulated herself, as soon as they were seated, on having preserved her gown from injury. "It would have been very shocking to have it torn," said she, "would not it? It is such a delicate muslin. For my part, I have not seen anything I like so well in the whole room, I assure you. How uncomfortable it is, whispered Catherine, not to have a single acquaintance here. Yes, my dear, replied Mrs. Allen, with perfect serenity, it is very uncomfortable indeed. What shall we do? The gentlemen and ladies at this table look as if they wondered why we came here. We seem forcing ourselves into their party. Aye, so we do. That is very disagreeable. I wish we had a large acquaintance here. I wish we had any, it would be somebody to go to. Very true, my dear, and if we knew anybody we would join them directly. The Skinners were here last year, I wish they were here now. Had not we better go away as it is? Here are no tea things for us, you see. No more there are, indeed. How very provoking. But I think we had better sit still, for one gets so tumbled in such a crowd. How is my head, my dear? Somebody gave me a push that has hurt it, I am afraid. No, indeed, it looks very nice. But, dear Mrs. Allen, are you sure there is nobody you know in all this multitude of people? I think you must know somebody. I don't, upon my word I wish I did. I wish I had a large acquaintance here with all my heart, and then I should get you a partner. I should be so glad to have you dance. There goes a strange-looking woman. What an odd gown she has got on. How old-fashioned it is. Look at the back. After some time they received an offer of tea from one of their neighbors. It was thankfully accepted, and this introduced a light conversation with the gentleman who offered it, which was the only time that anybody spoke to them during the evening, till they were discovered and joined by Mr. Allen when the dance was over. Well, Miss Morland, said he, directly, I hope you have had an agreeable ball. Very agreeable indeed, she replied, vainly endeavoring to hide a great yawn. I wish she had been able to dance, said his wife. I wish we could have got a partner for her. I have been saying how glad I should be if the Skinners were here this winter instead of last, or if the Perrys had come, as they talked of once, she might have danced with George Perry. I'm so sorry she has not had a partner. We shall do better another evening, I hope, was Mr. Allen's consolation. The company began to disperse when the dancing was over enough to leave space for the remainder to walk about in some comfort, and now was the time for a heroine, who had not yet played a very distinguished part in the events of the evening, to be noticed and admired. Every 5 minutes, by removing some of the crowd, gave greater openings for her charms. She was now seen by many young men who had not been near her before. Not one, however, started with rapturous wonder on beholding her. No whisper of eager inquiry ran round the room, nor was she once called a divinity by anybody. Yet Catherine was in very good looks, and had the company only seen her 3 years before, they would now have thought her exceedingly handsome. She was looked at, however, and with some admiration, for, in her own hearing, two gentlemen pronounced her to be a pretty girl. Such words had their due effect. She immediately thought the evening pleasanter than she had found it before. Her humble vanity was contented. She felt more obliged to the two young men for this simple praise than a true quality heroine would have been for 15 sonnets in celebration of her charms, and went to her chair in good humor with everybody, and perfectly satisfied with her share of public attention. Chapter 3. Every morning now brought its regular duties. Shops were to be visited, some new part of the town to be looked at, and the pump room to be attended, where they paraded up and down for an hour, looking at everybody and speaking to no one. The wish of a numerous acquaintance in Bath was still uppermost with Mrs. Allen, and she repeated it after every fresh proof, which every morning brought, of her knowing nobody at all. They made their appearance in the lower rooms, and here fortune was more favorable to our heroine. The master of the ceremonies introduced to her a very gentlemanlike young man as a partner. His name was Tilney. He seemed to be about 24 or 25, was rather tall, had a pleasing countenance, a very intelligent and lively eye, and, if not quite handsome, was very near it. His address was good, and Catherine felt herself in high luck. There was little leisure for speaking while they danced, but when they were seated at tea, she found him as agreeable as she had already given him credit for being. He talked with fluency and spirit, and there was an archness and pleasantry in his manner which interested, though it was hardly understood by her. After chatting some time on such matters as naturally arose from the objects around them, he suddenly addressed her with, "I have hitherto been very remiss, madam, in the proper attentions of a partner here. I have not yet asked you how long you have been in Bath, whether you were ever here before, whether you have been at the upper rooms, the theatre, and the concert, and how you like the place altogether. I have been very negligent, but are you now at leisure to satisfy me in these particulars? If you are, I will begin directly. You need not give yourself that trouble, sir. No trouble, I assure you, madam. Then forming his features into a set smile, and effectively softening his voice, he added, with a simpering air, have you been long in Bath, madam?
About a week, sir, replied Catherine, trying not to laugh.
Really? With affected astonishment.
Why should you be surprised, sir?
Why, indeed, said he, in his natural tone. But some emotion must appear to be raised by your reply, and surprise is more easily assumed, and not less reasonable than any other. Now let us go on. Were you never here before, madam?
Never, sir.
Indeed. Have you yet honored the upper rooms?
Yes, sir, I was there last Monday.
Have you been to the theater?
Yes, sir, I was at the play on Tuesday.
To the concert?
Yes, sir, on Wednesday.
And are you altogether pleased with Bath?
Yes, I like it very well.
Now I must give one smirk, and then we may be rational again. Catherine turned away her head, not knowing whether she might venture to laugh. I see what you think of me, said he gravely. I shall make but a poor figure in your journal tomorrow.
My journal?
Yes, I know exactly what you will say. Friday, went to the lower rooms, wore my sprigged muslin robe with blue trimmings, plain black shoes appeared to much advantage, but was strangely harassed by a queer, half-witted man, who would make me dance with him, and distressed me by his nonsense.
Indeed, I shall say no such thing.
Shall I tell you what you ought to say?
If you please.
I danced with a very agreeable young man, introduced by Mr. King, had a great deal of conversation with him, seems a most extraordinary genius, hope I may know more of him. That, madam, is what I wish you to say.
But, perhaps, I keep no journal.
Perhaps you are not sitting in this room, and I am not sitting by you. These are points in which a doubt is equally possible. Not keep a journal. How are your absent cousins to understand the tenor of your life in Bath without one? How are the civilities and compliments of every day to be related as they ought to be, unless noted down every evening in a journal? How are your various dresses to be remembered, and the particular state of your complexion, and curl of your hair to be described in all their diversities, without having constant recourse to a journal? My dear madam, I am not so ignorant of young ladies' ways as you wish to believe me. It is this delightful habit of journaling which largely contributes to form the easy style of writing for which ladies are so generally celebrated. Everybody allows that the talent of writing agreeable letters is peculiarly female. Nature may have done something, but I am sure it must be essentially assisted by the practice of keeping a journal.
I have sometimes thought, said Catherine, doubtingly, whether ladies do write so much better letters than gentlemen. That is, I should not think the superiority was always on our side.
As far as I have had opportunity of judging, it appears to me that the usual style of letter writing among women is faultless, except in three particulars.
And what are they?
A general deficiency of subject, a total inattention to stops, and a very frequent ignorance of grammar.
Upon my word, I need not have been afraid of disclaiming the compliment. You do not think too highly of us in that way.
I should no more lay it down as a general rule that women write better letters than men, than that they sing better duets, or draw better landscapes. In every power, of which taste is the foundation, excellence is pretty fairly divided between the sexes. They were interrupted by Mrs. Allen. My dear Catherine, said she, do take this pin out of my sleeve, I am afraid it has torn a hole already, I shall be quite sorry if it has, for this is a favorite gown, though it cost but 9 shillings a yard.
That is exactly what I should have guessed it, madam, said Mr. Tilney, looking at the muslin.
Do you understand muslins, sir?
Particularly well. I always buy my own cravats, and am allowed to be an excellent judge, and my sister has often trusted me in the choice of a gown. I bought one for her the other day, and it was pronounced to be a prodigious bargain by every lady who saw it. I gave but 5 shillings a yard for it, and a true Indian muslin.
Mrs. Allen was quite struck by his genius. Men commonly take so little notice of those things, said she. I can never get Mr. Allen to know one of my gowns from another. You must be a great comfort to your sister, sir.
I hope I am, madam.
And pray, sir, what do you think of Miss Morland's gown?
It is very pretty, madam, said he, gravely examining it, but I do not think it will wash well. I am afraid it will fray.
How can you, said Catherine, laughing, be so, she had almost said strange.
I am quite of your opinion, sir, replied Mrs. Allen, and so I told Miss Morland when she bought it.
But then you know, madam,
Muslin always turns to some account or other. Miss Moreland will get enough out of it for a handkerchief, or a cap, or a cloak. Muslin can never be said to be wasted. I have heard my sister say so 40 times, when she has been extravagant in buying more than she wanted, or careless in cutting it to pieces. Bath is a charming place, sir, there are so many good shops here. We are sadly off in the country, not but what we have very good shops in Salisbury, but it is so far to go 8 miles is a long way. Mr. Allen says it is 9, measured 9, but I am sure it cannot be more than 8, and it is such a fag I come back tired to death. Now, here one can step out of doors and get a thing in 5 minutes. Mr. Tilney was polite enough to seem interested in what she said, and she kept him on the subject of muslins till the dancing recommenced. Catherine feared, as she listened to their discourse, that he indulged himself a little too much with the foibles of others. "What are you thinking of so earnestly?" said he, as they walked back to the ballroom. "Not of your partner, I hope, for, by that shake of the head, your meditations are not satisfactory." Catherine colored, and said, "I was not thinking of anything." "That is artful and deep, to be sure, but I had rather be told at once that you will not tell me." "Well then, I will not. Thank you, for now we shall soon be acquainted, as I am authorized to tease you on this subject whenever we meet, and nothing in the world advances intimacy so much." They danced again, and, when the assembly closed, parted, on the lady's side at least, with a strong inclination for continuing the acquaintance. Whether she thought of him so much, while she drank her warm wine and water, and prepared herself for bed, as to dream of him when there, cannot be ascertained, but I hope it was no more than in a slight slumber, or a morning doze at most, for if it be true, as a celebrated writer has maintained, that no young lady can be justified in falling in love before the gentleman's love is declared, it must be very improper that a young lady should dream of a gentleman before the gentleman is first known to have dreamt of her. How proper Mr. Tilney might be as a dreamer or a lover had not yet perhaps entered Mr. Allen's head, but that he was not objectionable as a common acquaintance for his young charge he was on inquiry satisfied, for he had early in the evening taken pains to know who her partner was, and had been assured of Mr. Tilney's being a clergyman, and of a very respectable family in Gloucestershire. Chapter 4. With more than usual eagerness did Catherine hasten to the pump room the next day, secure within herself of seeing Mr. Tilney there before the morning were over, and ready to meet him with a smile, but no smile was demanded. Mr. Tilney did not appear. Every creature in Bath, except himself, was to be seen in the room at different periods of the fashionable hours. Crowds of people were every moment passing in and out, up the steps and down, people whom nobody cared about, and nobody wanted to see, and he only was absent. "What a delightful place Bath is," said Mrs. Allen as they sat down near the great clock, after parading the room till they were tired, "and how pleasant it would be if we had any acquaintance here." This sentiment had been uttered so often in vain that Mrs. Allen had no particular reason to hope it would be followed with more advantage now, but we are told to despair of nothing we would attain, as unwearied diligence our point would gain, and the unwearied diligence with which she had every day wished for the same thing was at length to have its just reward, for hardly had she been seated 10 minutes before a lady of about her own age, who was sitting by her, and had been looking at her attentively for several minutes, addressed her with great complacence in these words, "I think, madam, I cannot be mistaken, it is a long time since I had the pleasure of seeing you, but is not your name Allen?" This question answered, as it readily was, the stranger pronounced hers to be Thorpe, and Mrs. Allen immediately recognized the features of a former schoolfellow and intimate, whom she had seen only once since their respective marriages, and that many years ago. Their joy on this meeting was very great, as well it might, since they had been contented to know nothing of each other for the last 15 years. Compliments on good looks now passed, and, after observing how time had slipped away since they were last together, how little they had thought of meeting in Bath, and what a pleasure it was to see an old friend, they proceeded to make inquiries and give intelligence as to their families, sisters, and cousins, talking both together, far more ready to give than to receive information, and each hearing very little of what the other said. Mrs. Thorpe, however, had one great advantage as a talker, over Mrs. Allen, in a family of children, and when she expatiated on the talents of her sons, and the beauty of her daughters, when she related their different situations and views that John was at Oxford, Edward at Merchant Taylors, and William at sea and all of them more beloved and respected in their different station than any other three beings ever were, Mrs. Allen had no similar information to give, no similar triumphs to press on the unwilling and unbelieving ear of her friend, and was forced to sit and appear to listen to all these maternal effusions, consoling herself, however, with the discovery, which her keen eye soon made, that the lace on Mrs. Thorpe's pelisse was not half so handsome as that on her own. "Here come my dear girls," cried Mrs. Thorpe, pointing at three smart-looking females who, arm in arm, were then moving towards her. "My dear Mrs. Allen, I long to introduce them, they will be so delighted to see you. The tallest is Isabella, my eldest, is not she a fine young woman? The others are very much admired too, but I believe Isabella is the handsomest." The Miss Thorpes were introduced, and Miss Morland, who had been for a short time forgotten, was introduced likewise. The name seemed to strike them all, and, after speaking to her with great civility, the eldest young lady observed aloud to the rest, "How excessively like her brother Miss Morland is." "The very picture of him indeed," cried the mother, "and I should have known her anywhere for his sister," was repeated by them all, two or three times over. For a moment Catherine was surprised, but Mrs. Thorpe and her daughters had scarcely begun the history of their acquaintance with Mr. James Morland, before she remembered that her eldest brother had lately formed an intimacy with a young man of his own college, of the name of Thorpe, and that he had spent the last week of the Christmas vacation with his family, near London. The whole being explained, many obliging things were said by the Miss Thorpes of their wish of being better acquainted with her, of being considered as already friends, through the friendship of their brothers, etc., which Catherine heard with pleasure, and answered with all the pretty expressions she could command, and, as the first proof of amity, she was soon invited to accept an arm of the eldest Miss Thorpe, and take a turn with her about the room. Catherine was delighted with this extension of her Bath acquaintance, and almost forgot Mr. Tilney while she talked to Miss Thorpe. Friendship is certainly the finest balm for the pangs of disappointed love. Their conversation turned upon those subjects, of which the free discussion has generally much to do in perfecting a sudden intimacy between two young ladies, such as dress, balls, flirtations, and quizzes. Miss Thorpe, however, being 4 years older than Miss Morland, and at least 4 years better informed, had a very decided advantage in discussing such points. She could compare the balls of Bath with those of Tunbridge, its fashions with the fashions of London, could rectify the opinions of her new friend in many articles of tasteful attire, could discover flirtation between any gentleman and lady who only smiled on each other, and point out a quiz through the thickness of a crowd. These powers received due admiration from Catherine, to whom they were entirely new, and the respect which they naturally inspired might have been too great for familiarity, had not the easy gaiety of Miss Thorpe's manners, and her frequent expressions of delight on this acquaintance with her, softened down every feeling of awe, and left nothing but tender affection. Their increasing attachment was not to be satisfied with half a dozen turns in the pump room, but required, when they all quitted it together, that Miss Thorpe should accompany Miss Morland to the very door of Mr. Allen's house, and that they should there part with a most affectionate and lengthened shake of hands, after learning, to their mutual relief, that they should see each other across the theatre at night, and say their prayers in the same chapel the next morning. Catherine then ran directly upstairs, and watched Miss Thorpe's progress down the street from the drawing-room window, admired the graceful spirit of her walk, the fashionable air of her figure and dress, and felt grateful, as well she might, for the chance which had procured her such a friend. Mrs. Thorpe was a widow, and not a very rich one. She was a good-humored, well-meaning woman, and a very indulgent mother. Her eldest daughter had great personal beauty, and the younger ones, by pretending to be as handsome as their sister, imitating her air, and dressing in the same style, did very well. This brief account of the family is intended to supersede the necessity of a long and minute detail from Mrs. Thorpe herself, of her past adventures and sufferings, which might otherwise be expected to occupy the three or four following chapters, in which the worthlessness of lords and attorneys might be set forth, and conversations, which had passed 20 years before, be minutely repeated. Chapter 5. Catherine was not so much engaged at the theatre that evening, in returning the nods and smiles of Miss Thorpe, though they certainly claimed much of her leisure, as to forget to look with an inquiring eye for Mr. Tilney in every box which her eye could reach, but she looked in vain. Mr. Tilney was no fonder of the play than the pump room. She hoped to be more fortunate the next day, and when her wishes for fine weather were answered by seeing a beautiful morning, she hardly felt a doubt of it. For a fine Sunday in Bath empties every house of its inhabitants, and all the world appears on such an occasion to walk about and tell their acquaintance what a charming day it is. As soon as divine service was over, the Thorpes and Allens eagerly joined each other, and after staying long enough in the pump room to discover that the crowd was insupportable, and that there was not a genteel face to be seen, which everybody discovers every Sunday throughout the season, they hastened away to the Crescent, to breathe the fresh air of better company. Here Catherine and Isabella, Arm in arm, again tasted the sweets of friendship in an unreserved conversation. They talked much, and with much enjoyment, but again was Catherine disappointed in her hope of re-seeing her partner. He was nowhere to be met with. Every search for him was equally unsuccessful, in morning lounges or evening assemblies, neither at the upper nor lower rooms, at dressed or undressed balls, was he perceivable, nor among the walkers, the horsemen, or the curricle drivers of the morning. His name was not in the pump room book, and curiosity could do no more. He must be gone from Bath. Yet he had not mentioned that his stay would be so short. This sort of mysteriousness, which is always so becoming in a hero, threw a fresh grace in Catherine's imagination around his person and manners, and increased her anxiety to know more of him. From the Thorpes she could learn nothing, for they had been only 2 days in Bath before they met with Mrs. Allen. It was a subject, however, in which she often indulged with her fair friend, from whom she received every possible encouragement to continue to think of him, and his impression on her fancy was not suffered therefore to weaken. Isabella was very sure that he must be a charming young man, and was equally sure that he must have been delighted with her dear Catherine, and would therefore shortly return. She liked him the better for being a clergyman, for she must confess herself very partial to the profession, and something like a sigh escaped her as she said it. Perhaps Catherine was wrong in not demanding the cause of that gentle emotion, but she was not experienced enough in the finesse of love, or the duties of friendship, to know when delicate raillery was properly called for, or when a confidence should be forced. Mrs. Allen was now quite happy, quite satisfied with Bath. She had found some acquaintance, had been so lucky too as to find in them the family of a most worthy old friend, and, as the completion of good fortune, had found these friends by no means so expensively dressed as herself. Her daily expressions were no longer, "I wish we had some acquaintance in Bath." They were changed into, "How glad I am we have met with Mrs. Thorpe." And she was as eager in promoting the intercourse of the two families, as her young charge and Isabella themselves could be, never satisfied with the day unless she spent the chief of it by the side of Mrs. Thorpe, in what they called conversation, but in which there was scarcely ever any exchange of opinion, and not often any resemblance of subject, for Mrs. Thorpe talked chiefly of her children, and Mrs. Allen of her gowns. The progress of the friendship between Catherine and Isabella was quick as its beginning had been warm, and they passed so rapidly through every gradation of increasing tenderness that there was shortly no fresh proof of it to be given to their friends or themselves. They called each other by their Christian name, were always arm in arm when they walked, pinned up each other's train for the dance, and were not to be divided in the set, and if a rainy morning deprived them of other enjoyments, they were still resolute in meeting in defiance of wet and dirt, and shut themselves up, to read novels together. Yes, novels, for I will not adopt that ungenerous and impolitic custom so common with novel writers, of degrading by their contemptuous censure the very performances, to the number of which they are themselves adding, joining with their greatest enemies in bestowing the harshest epithets on such works, and scarcely ever permitting them to be read by their own heroine, who, if she accidentally take up a novel, is sure to turn over its insipid pages with disgust. Alas! If the heroine of one novel be not patronized by the heroine of another, from whom can she expect protection and regard? I cannot approve of it. Let us leave it to the reviewers to abuse such effusions of fancy at their leisure, and over every new novel to talk in threadbare strains of the trash with which the press now groans. Let us not desert one another, we are an injured body. Although our productions have afforded more extensive and unaffected pleasure than those of any other literary corporation in the world, no species of composition has been so much decried. From pride, ignorance, or fashion, our foes are almost as many as our readers. And while the abilities of the 900th abridger of the History of England, or of the man who collects and publishes in a volume some dozen lines of Milton, Pope, and Prior, with a paper from the Spectator, and a chapter from Sterne, are eulogized by 1,000 pence, there seems almost a general wish of decrying the capacity and undervaluing the labor of the novelist, and of slighting the performances which have only genius, wit, and taste to recommend them. I'm no novel reader, I seldom look into novels, do not imagine that I often read novels, it is really very well for a novel. Such is the common cant. And what are you reading, miss? Oh, it is only a novel, replies the young lady, while she lays down her book with affected indifference, or momentary shame. It is only Cecilia, or Camilla, or Belinda, or, in short, only some work in which the greatest powers of the mind are displayed, in which the most thorough knowledge of human nature, the happiest delineation of its varieties, the liveliest effusions of wit and humor, are conveyed to the world in the best chosen language. Now, had the same young lady been engaged with a volume of the Spectator, instead of such a work, How proudly would she have produced the book, and told its name, though the chances must be against her being occupied by any part of that voluminous publication, of which either the matter or manner would not disgust a young person of taste, the substance of its papers so often consisting in the statement of improbable circumstances, unnatural characters, and topics of conversation which no longer concern anyone living, and their language, too, frequently so coarse as to give no very favorable idea of the age that could endure it. Chapter 6. The following conversation, which took place between the two friends in the pump room one morning, after an acquaintance of 8 or 9 days, is given as a specimen of their very warm attachment, and of the delicacy, discretion, originality of thought, and literary taste which marked the reasonableness of that attachment. They met by appointment, and as Isabella had arrived nearly 5 minutes before her friend, her first address naturally was, "My dearest creature, what can have made you so late? I have been waiting for you at least this age." "Have you, indeed? I'm very sorry for it, but really I thought I was in very good time. It is but just one. I hope you have not been here long?" "Oh, these 10 ages at least. I'm sure I have been here this half hour. But now, let us go and sit down at the other end of the room, and enjoy ourselves. I have 100 things to say to you. In the first place, I was so afraid it would rain this morning, just as I wanted to set off, it looked very showery, and that would have thrown me into agonies. Do you know, I saw the prettiest hat you can imagine, in a shop window in Milsom Street just now, very like yours, only with coquelicot ribbons instead of green. I quite longed for it. But, my dearest Catherine, what have you been doing with yourself all this morning? Have you gone on with Udolpho?"
"Yes, I have been reading it ever since I woke, and I am got to the Black Veil."
"Are you, indeed? How delightful. Oh, I would not tell you what is behind the Black Veil for the world. Are not you wild to know?"
"Oh, yes, quite. What can it be? But do not tell me. I would not be told upon any account. I know it must be a skeleton. I am sure it is Laurentina's skeleton. Oh, I am delighted with the book. I should like to spend my whole life in reading it. I assure you, if it had not been to meet you, I would not have come away from it for all the world. Dear creature, how much I am obliged to you, and when you have finished Udolpho, we will read the Italian together, and I have made out a list of 10 or 12 more of the same kind for you."
"Have you, indeed? How glad I am. What are they all?"
"I will read you their names directly. Here they are, in my pocketbook: Castle of Wolfenbach, Claremont, Mysterious Warnings, Necromancer of the Black Forest, Midnight Bell, Orphan of the Rhine, and Horrid Mysteries. Those will last us some time."
"Yes, pretty well, but are they all horrid? Are you sure they are all horrid?"
"Yes, quite sure, for a particular friend of mine, a Miss Andrews, a sweet girl, one of the sweetest creatures in the world, has read every one of them. I wish you knew Miss Andrews, you would be delighted with her. She is netting herself the sweetest cloak you can conceive. I think her as beautiful as an angel, and I am so vexed with the men for not admiring her. I scold them all amazingly about it."
"Scold them? Do you scold them for not admiring her?"
"Yes, that I do. There is nothing I would not do for those who are really my friends. I have no notion of loving people by halves, it is not my nature. My attachments are always excessively strong. I told Captain Hunt at one of our assemblies this winter that if he was to tease me all night, I would not dance with him, unless he would allow Miss Andrews to be as beautiful as an angel. The men think us incapable of real friendship, you know, and I am determined to show them the difference. Now, if I were to hear anybody speak slightingly of you, I should fire up in a moment, but that is not at all likely, for you are just the kind of girl to be a great favorite with the men."
"Oh, dear!" cried Catherine, coloring. "How can you say so? I know you very well. You have so much animation, which is exactly what Miss Andrews wants, for I must confess there is something amazingly insipid about her. Oh, I must tell you, that just after we parted yesterday, I saw a young man looking at you so earnestly I am sure he is in love with you."
Catherine colored, and disclaimed again. Isabella laughed. "It is very true, upon my honor, but I see how it is. You are indifferent to everybody's admiration, except that of one gentleman, who shall be nameless. Nay, I cannot blame you. Speaking more seriously, your feelings are easily understood. Where the heart is really attached, I know very well how little one can be pleased with the attention of anybody else. Everything is so insipid, so uninteresting, that does not relate to the beloved object. I can perfectly comprehend your feelings." But you should not persuade me that I think so very much about Mr. Tilney, for perhaps I may never see him again.
Not see him again. My dearest creature, do not talk of it. I'm sure you would be miserable if you thought so.
No, indeed, I should not. I do not pretend to say that I was not very much pleased with him, but while I have Udolpho to read, I feel as if nobody could make me miserable.
Oh! The dreadful black veil. My dear Isabella, I am sure there must be Laurentina's skeleton behind it.
It is so odd to me, that you should never have read Udolpho before, but I suppose Mrs. Morland objects to novels.
No, she does not. She very often reads Sir Charles Grandison herself, but new books do not fall in our way.
Sir Charles Grandison. That is an amazing horrid book, is it not? I remember Miss Andrews could not get through the first volume.
It is not like Udolpho at all, but yet I think it is very entertaining.
Do you indeed? You surprise me, I thought it had not been readable. But, my dearest Catherine, have you settled what to wear on your head tonight? I am determined at all events to be dressed exactly like you. The men take notice of that sometimes, you know.
But it does not signify if they do, said Catherine, very innocently.
Signify? Oh, heavens! I make it a rule never to mind what they say. They are very often amazingly impertinent if you do not treat them with spirit, and make them keep their distance.
Are they?
Well, I never observed that. They always behave very well to me.
Oh! They give themselves such airs. They are the most conceited creatures in the world, and think themselves of so much importance. By the by, though I have thought of it 100 times, I have always forgot to ask you what is your favorite complexion in a man. Do you like them best dark or fair?
I hardly know. I never much thought about it. Something between both, I think. Brown not fair, and a not very dark.
Very well, Catherine. That is exactly he. I have not forgot your description of Mr. Tilney, a brown skin, with dark eyes, and rather dark hair.
Well, my taste is different. I prefer light eyes, and as to complexion, do you know I like a sallow better than any other? You must not betray me, if you should ever meet with one of your acquaintance answering that description.
Betray you? What do you mean?
Nay, do not distress me. I believe I have said too much. Let us drop the subject.
Catherine, in some amazement, complied, and after remaining a few moments silent, was on the point of reverting to what interested her at that time rather more than anything else in the world, Laurentina's skeleton, when her friend prevented her, by saying, "For heaven's sake, let us move away from this end of the room. Do you know, there are 2 odious young men who have been staring at me this half hour. They really put me quite out of countenance. Let us go and look at the arrivals. They will hardly follow us there." Away they walked to the book, and while Isabella examined the names, it was Catherine's employment to watch the proceedings of these alarming young men.
"They are not coming this way, are they? I hope they are not so impertinent as to follow us. Pray let me know if they are coming. I am determined I will not look up." In a few moments Catherine, with unaffected pleasure, assured her that she need not be longer uneasy, as the gentleman had just left the pump room.
"And which way are they gone?" said Isabella, turning hastily round. "One was a very good-looking young man."
"They went towards the churchyard."
"Well, I am amazingly glad I have got rid of them. And now, what say you to going to Edgar's Buildings with me, and looking at my new hat? You said you should like to see it."
Catherine readily agreed. "Only," she added, "perhaps we may overtake the 2 young men.
"Oh! Never mind that. If we make haste, we shall pass by them presently, and I am dying to show you my hat. But if we only wait a few minutes, there will be no danger of our seeing them at all."
"I shall not pay them any such compliment, I assure you. I have no notion of treating men with such respect. That is the way to spoil them."
Catherine had nothing to oppose against such reasoning, and therefore, to show the independence of Miss Thorpe, and her resolution of humbling the sex, they set off immediately as fast as they could walk, in pursuit of the 2 young men.
Chapter 7. Half a minute conducted them through the pump yard to the archway, opposite Union Passage, but here they were stopped. Everybody acquainted with Bath may remember the difficulties of crossing Cheap Street at this point. It is indeed a street of so impertinent a nature, so unfortunately connected with the great London and Oxford roads, and the principal inn of the city, that a day never passes in which parties of ladies, however important their business, whether in quest of pastry, millinery, or even, as in the present case, of young men, are not detained on one side or other by carriages, horsemen, or carts.
This evil had been felt and lamented, at least 3 times a day, by Isabella since her residence in Bath, and she was now fated to feel and lament it once more, for at the very moment of coming opposite to Union Passage, and within view of the 2 gentlemen who were proceeding through the crowds, and threading the gutters of that interesting alley, they were prevented crossing by the approach of a gig, driven along on bad pavement by a most knowing-looking coachman with all the vehemence that could most fitly endanger the lives of himself, his companion, and his horse. "Oh, these odious gigs," said Isabella, looking up. "How I detest them." But this detestation, though so just, was of short duration, for she looked again and exclaimed, "Delightful! Mr. Morland and my brother." "Good heaven! 'Tis James!" was uttered at the same moment by Catherine, and, on catching the young men's eyes, the horse was immediately checked with a violence which almost threw him on his haunches, and the servant having now scampered up, the gentleman jumped out, and the equipage was delivered to his care. Catherine, by whom this meeting was wholly unexpected, received her brother with the liveliest pleasure, and he, being of a very amiable disposition, and sincerely attached to her, gave every proof on his side of equal satisfaction, which he could have leisure to do, while the bright eyes of Miss Thorpe were incessantly challenging his notice, and to her his devoirs were speedily paid, with a mixture of joy and embarrassment which might have informed Catherine, had she been more expert in the development of other people's feelings, and less simply engrossed by her own, that her brother thought her friend quite as pretty as she could do herself. John Thorpe, who in the meantime had been giving orders about the horses, soon joined them, and from him she directly received the amends which were her due, for while he slightly and carelessly touched the hand of Isabella, on her he bestowed a whole scrape and half a short bow. He was a stout young man of middling height, who, with a plain face and ungraceful form, seemed fearful of being too handsome unless he wore the dress of a groom, and too much like a gentleman unless he were easy where he ought to be civil, and impudent where he might be allowed to be easy. He took out his watch. "How long do you think we have been running it from Tetbury, Mississippi, Moreland?" "I do not know the distance." Her brother told her that it was 23 miles.
23, cried Thorpe.
25 if it is an inch. Moreland remonstrated, pleaded the authority of road books, innkeepers, and milestones, but his friend disregarded them all. He had a surer test of distance. "I know it must be 25, said he, "by the time we have been doing it. It is now 1:30. We drove out of the inn yard at Tetbury as the town clock struck 11, and I defy any man in England to make my horse go less than 10 miles an hour in harness. That makes it exactly 25.
"You have lost an hour," said Moreland. "It was only 10 o'clock when we came from Tetbury."
10 o'clock. It was 11, upon my soul. I counted every stroke. This brother of yours would persuade me out of my senses. Miss Moreland, do but look at my horse. Did you ever see an animal so made for speed in your life?" The servant had just mounted the carriage and was driving off. Such true blood! 3 hours and a half indeed, coming only 23 miles. Look at that creature, and suppose it possible if you can.
He does look very hot, to be sure.
Hot! He had not turned a hair till we came to Walcott Church, but look at his forehand, look at his loins, only see how he moves. That horse cannot go less than 10 miles an hour. Tie his legs and he will get on. What do you think of my gig, Miss Moreland? A neat one, is not it? Well hung, town built. I have not had it a month. It was built for a Christchurch man, a friend of mine, a very good sort of fellow. He ran it a few weeks, till, I believe, it was convenient to have done with it. I happened just then to be looking out for some light thing of the kind, though I had pretty well determined on a curricle too, but I chanced to meet him on Magdalen Bridge, as he was driving into Oxford, last term. "Ah, Thorpe," said he, "do you happen to want such a little thing as this? It is a capital one of the kind, but I am cursed tired of it."
"Oh, D," said I am your man. What do you ask? And how much do you think he did, Miss Moreland?"
"I'm sure I cannot guess at all. Curricle hung, you see, seat, trunk, sword case, splashing board, lamps, silver molding, all you see complete, the ironwork as good as new, or better. He asked 50 guineas, I closed with him directly, threw down the money, and the carriage was mine."
"And I am sure," said Catherine, "I know so little of such things that I cannot judge whether it was cheap or dear.
Neither one nor t'other. I might have got it for less, I dare say, but I hate haggling, and poor Freeman wanted cash."
"That was very good-natured of you," said Catherine, quite pleased.
"Oh, D, it, when one has the means of doing a kind thing by a friend, I hate to be pitiful. An inquiry now took place into the intended movements of the young ladies, and, on finding whither they were going, it was decided that the gentlemen should accompany them to Edgar's buildings, and pay their respects to Mrs. Thorpe. James and Isabella led the way, and so well satisfied was the latter with her lot, so contentedly was she endeavoring to ensure a pleasant walk to him who brought the double recommendation of being her brother's friend, and her friend's brother, so pure and uncoquettish were her feelings, that, though they overtook and passed the two offending young men in Milsom Street, she was so far from seeking to attract their notice, that she looked back at them only three times. John Thorpe kept of course with Catherine, and, after a few minutes' silence, renewed the conversation about his gig. You will find, however, Miss Morland, it would be reckoned a cheap thing by some people, for I might have sold it for 10 guineas more the next day. Jackson, of Oriel, bid me 60 at once. Morland was with me at the time. Yes, said Morland, who overheard this, but you forget that your horse was included. My horse. Oh, D, it. I would not sell my horse for 100. Are you fond of an open carriage, Miss Morland? Yes, very. I have hardly ever an opportunity of being in one, but I am particularly fond of it. I am glad of it. I will drive you out in mine every day. Thank you, said Catherine, in some distress, from a doubt of the propriety of accepting such an offer. I will drive you up Lansdowne Hill tomorrow. Thank you, but will not your horse want rest? Rest. He has only come 23 miles today, all nonsense. Nothing ruins horses so much as rest. Nothing knocks them up so soon. No, no, I shall exercise mine at the average of 4 hours every day while I am here. Shall you indeed? Said Catherine very seriously. That will be 40 miles a day. 40. Aye, 50, for what I care. Well, I will drive you up Lansdowne tomorrow, mind, I am engaged. How delightful that will be! Cried Isabella, turning round. My dearest Catherine, I quite envy you, but I am afraid, brother, you will not have room for a third. A third indeed. No, no, I did not come to Bath to drive my sisters about, that would be a good joke, faith. Morland must take care of you. This brought on a dialogue of civilities between the other two, but Catherine heard neither the particulars nor the result. Her companion's discourse now sunk from its hitherto animated pitch to nothing more than a short decisive sentence of praise or condemnation on the face of every woman they met, and Catherine, after listening and agreeing as long as she could, with all the civility and deference of the youthful female mind, fearful of hazarding an opinion of its own in opposition to that of a self-assured man, especially where the beauty of her own sex is concerned, ventured at length to vary the subject by a question which had been long uppermost in her thoughts. It was, have you ever read Udolpho, Mr. Thorpe? Udolpho. Oh, Lord. Not I, never read novels, I have something else to do. Catherine, humbled and ashamed, was going to apologize for her question, but he prevented her by saying, novels are all so full of nonsense and stuff, there has not been a tolerably decent one come out since Tom Jones, except The Monk, I read that t'other day, but as for all the others, they are the stupidest things in creation. I think you must like Udolpho, if you were to read it, it is so very interesting. Not I, faith. No, if I read any, it shall be Mrs. Radcliffe's, her novels are amusing enough, they are worth reading, some fun and nature in them. Udolpho was written by Mrs. Radcliffe, said Catherine, with some hesitation, from the fear of mortifying him. No sure, was it? I remember, so it was, I was thinking of that other stupid book, written by that woman they make such a fuss about, she who married the French emigrant. I suppose you mean Camilla? Yes, that's the book, such unnatural stuff. An old man playing at seesaw, I took up the first volume once and looked it over, but I soon found it would not do, indeed I guessed what sort of stuff it must be before I saw it, as soon as I heard she had married an emigrant, I was sure I should never be able to get through it. I have never read it. You had no loss, I assure you. It is the horridest nonsense you can imagine, there is nothing in the world in it but an old man's playing at seesaw and learning Latin, upon my soul there is not. This critique, the justness of which was unfortunately lost on poor Catherine, brought them to the door of Mrs. Thorpe's lodgings, and the feelings of the discerning and unprejudiced reader of Camilla gave way to the feelings of the dutiful and affectionate son, as they met Mrs. Thorpe, who had described them from above, in the passage. Ah, mother! How do you do? Said he, giving her a hearty shake of the hand.